think the colour was due entirely to the sun, though. "My ablutions can wait," he said. "First, I wish to know the meaning of yon wee charade." He fixed Mr. Campbell with a dark blue look. "I'm lured to the forest upon the pretext of smelling turpentine, and before I ken where I am, I'm sitting with the British Navy, saying aye and nay to matters I ken nothing of, wi' yon wee manny kicking my shins under the table like a trained monkey."
Jocasta smiled at that. Campbell sighed. In spite of the exertions of the day, his neat coat showed no signs of dust, and his old-fashioned peruke sat squarely on his head.
"You have my apologies, Mr. Fraser, for what must seem a monstrous imposition upon your good nature. As it is, your arrival was fortuitous in the extreme, but did not allow sufficient time for communications to be made. I was in Asverasborough until last evening, and by the time I received word of your arrival, it was much too late for me to ride here to acquaint you with the circumstances."
"Indeed.
Well, as I perceive we have a bit of time at present, I invite you to do so now," Jamie said, with a slight click as his teeth closed on the now.
"Will you not sit down first, nephew?" Jocasta put in with a graceful wave of her hand. "It'll take a bit of talk to explain, and you've had a tiring day of it, no?"
Ulysses had materialized out of the ether with a linen sheet over his arm. He spread this over a chair with a flourish and gestured to Jamie to sit down. Jamie eyed the butler narrowly, but it had been a tiring day. I could see blisters amid the soot on his hands, and sweat had made clear runnels in the filth on face and neck. He sank slowly into the proffered chair and allowed a silver cup to be put into his hand. A similar cup appeared as if by magic in my own hand, and I smiled in gratitude at the butler. I hadn't been hoiking logs about, but the long, hot ride had worn me out. I took a deep, appreciative sip, a lovely, cool, rough cider that bit the tongue and slaked the thirst at once. Jamie took a deep draught and looked a little calmer.
"Well then, Mr. Campbell." "It's a matter of the Navy," Campbell began. And Jocasta snorted. "A matter of Lieutenant Wolfe, you mean," she corrected. "For your purposes, the same, Joe, and well you know it," Mr. Campbell said a little sharply.
He turned back to Jamie to explain. The majority of River Run's revenues were, as Jocasta had told us, derived from the sale of its timber and turpentine products, the largest and most profitable customer being the British Navy.
"But the Navy's not what it was," Mr. Campbell said, shaking his head regretfully. "During the war with the French, they could scarce keep the fleet supplied, and any man with a working sawmill was rich. But for the last 10 years it's been peaceful, and the ships left to rot. The Admiralty's not laid a new keel in 5 years.
He sighed at the unfortunate economic consequences of peace. The Navy did still require such stores as pitch and turpentine and spars. With a leaky fleet to keep afloat, tar would always find a market. However, the market had shrunk severely, and the Navy now could pick and choose those landowners with whom they did business. The Navy, requiring dependability above all things, their covetable contracts were renewed quarterly upon inspection and approval by a senior naval officer, in this case, Wolf. Always difficult to deal with, Wolf had nonetheless been adroitly managed by Hector Cameron until the latter's death.
"Hector drank with him," Jocasta put in bluntly, "and when he left, there'd be a bottle in his saddlebag and a bit besides."
The death of Hector Cameron, though, had severely affected the business of the estate.
"And not only because there's less for bribes," Campbell said, with a sidelong glance at Jocasta.
He cleared his throat primly. Lieutenant Wolfe, it seemed, had come to give his condolences to the widow Cameron upon the death of her husband, properly uniformed, attended by his ensigns. He had come back again the next day, alone, with a proposal of marriage. Jamie, caught mid-swallow, choked on his drink. It wasn't in a person the man was interested in, Jocasta said sharply, hearing this. It was my land. Jamie wisely decided not to comment, merely eyeing his aunt with new interest. Having heard the background, I thought she was likely right. Wolfe's interest was in acquiring a profitable plantation which could be rendered still more profitable by means of the naval contracts his influence could assure. At the same time, the person of Jocasta Cameron was no small added inducement. Blind or not, she was a striking woman. Beyond the simple beauty of flesh and bone, though, she exuded a sensual vitality that caused even such a dry stick as Farquhar Campbell to ignite when she was near.
"I suppose that explains the lieutenant's offensive behaviour at lunch," I said, interested. "Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned, but the blokes don't like it either."
Jocasta turned her head toward me, startled. I think she'd forgotten I was there. But Farquhar Campbell laughed.
"Indeed they don't, Mrs. Freezer," he assured me,
eyes twinkling.
"We're fragile things, we poor men. You trifle with our affections at your peril."
Jocasta gave an unladylike snort at this.
"Affections forby," she said. "The man has nae affection for anything that doesna come in a bottle."
Jamie was eyeing Mr. Campbell with a certain amount of interest.
"Since she rees the manner of affections, aunt," he said, with a small edge, "might I inquire as to the interests of your particular friend?"
Mr. Campbell returned the stare.
"I've a wife at home, sir," he said dryly, "and 8 wains, the eldest of whom is perhaps a few years older than yourself. But I kent Hector Cameron for more than 30 years, and I'll do my best by his wife for the sake of his friendship and hers."
Jocasta laid a hand on his arm and turned her head toward him. If she could no longer use her eyes for impression, she still knew the effect of down-swept lashes.
"Farquhar has been a great help to me, Jamie," she said, with a touch of reproof. "I couldn't have managed without his assistance after poor Hector died." "Why," Jamie said, with no more than a hint of scepticism. "And I'm sure I must be as grateful to you as my aunt is, sir. But I'm still wondering just a bit where I come into this deal."
Campbell coughed discreetly and went on with his story. Jocasta had put off the lieutenant, feigning collapse from the stress of bereavement, and had herself carried to her bedroom, from which she didn't emerge until he had concluded his business in Cross Creek and left for Wilmington.
"Burns managed the contracts that time, and a fine mess he made of them," Jocasta put in. "Ah, Mr. Burns, the invisible overseer. And where was he this morning?"
A maid had appeared with a bowl of warm perfumed water and a towel. Without asking, she knelt by Jamie's chair, took one of his hands, and began gently to wash the soot away. Jamie looked slightly taken aback by this attention, but was too occupied by the conversation to send her away. A slight wry smile crossed Campbell's face.
"I'm afraid Mr. Burns, though usually a competent overseer, shares one small weakness with the lieutenant. I sent to the sawmill for him first thing, but the slave came back and told me Burns was insensible in his quarters, reeking of drink, and could not be roused."
Jocasta made another unladylike noise, which caused Campbell to glance at her with affection before turning back to Jamie.
"Your aunt is more than capable of managing the business of the estate with Ulysses to assist her in the documentary aspects. However, as you will have seen yourself..."
He gestured delicately at the bowl of water, which now resembled a bowl of ink.
"There are physical concerns to the running of it as well." "That was the point that Lieutenant Wolfe put to me," Jocasta said, lips thinning at the memory, "that I could not expect to manage my property alone, and me not only a woman, but sightless as well. I could not, he said, depend upon Burns, unable as I am to go to the forest and the mill to see what the man is doing. Or not doing."
Her mouth shut firmly on the thought.
"Which is true enough," Campbell put in ruefully. "It is a proverb amongst us. happiness is a son old enough to be a factor. For when it is a matter of money or slaves, you cannot trust anyone save your kin.
I drew a deep breath and glanced at Jamie, who nodded. At last we'd got to it.
And that, I said, is where Jamie comes in. Am I right?
Jocasta had already enlisted Farquhar Campbell to deal with Lieutenant Wolfe upon his next visit, intending that Campbell should keep Burns from committing folly with the contracts. When we had so opportunely arrived, though, Jocasta had hit upon a better plan.
I sent word to Farquhar that he should inform the lieutenant that my nephew had come to take up the management of River Run.
That would cause him to go cautiously, she explained,
for he would not dare to press me with a kinsman who had an interest standing by.
I see.
Despite himself, Jamie was beginning to look amused.
So the lieutenant would think his attempt at a good downsetting here was usurped by my arrival. No wonder the man seemed to take such a mislike to me. I thought it was perhaps a general disgust of Scotsmen that he had, from what he said.
I should imagine that he has. Now, Campbell said, dabbing his lips circumspectly with his napkin.
Jocasta reached across the table, groping, and Jamie put out his hand instinctively to hers.
You will forgive me, nephew, she said.
With his hand to guide her, she could look toward his face. One wouldn't have known her blind by the expression of pleading in her beautiful blue eyes.
I knew nothing of your character, do you see, before you came. I could not risk that you would refuse a part in the deception, did I tell you of it first. Do say that you hold no grudge toward me, Jamie, if only for sweet Ellen's sake.
Jamie squeezed her hand gently, assuring her that he held no grudge. Indeed, he was pleased to have come in time to help, and his aunt might count upon his assistance in any way she chose to call upon him. Mr. Campbell beamed and rang the bell. Ulysses brought in the special whiskey with a tray of crystal goblets and a plate of savouries, and we drank confusion to the British Navy. Looking at that fine-boned face, so full of blind eloquence, though, I couldn't help recalling the brief synopsis Jamie had once given me of the outstanding characteristics of the members of his family.
"Freezers are stubborn as rocks," he'd said, "and Mackenzies are charming as larks in the field, but sly as foxes with it."
"And where have you been?"
Jamie asked, giving Fergus a hard up-and-down.
"I didn't think you'd money enough for what it looks as though you've been doing."
Fergus smoothed his dishevelled hair and sat down, radiating offended dignity.
"I met with a pair of French fur traders in the town. They speaking little English, and myself being fluent, I could not but agree to assist them in their transactions. If they should then choose to invite me to share a small supper at their inn?"
He lifted one shoulder in Gallic dismissal of the matter, and turned to more immediate concerns, reaching inside his shirt for a letter.
"This had arrived in Cross Creek for you," he said, handing it to Jamie. "The postmaster asked me to bring it."
It was a thick packet of paper with a battered seal, and looked in little better condition than did Fergus. Jamie's face lighted when he saw it, though he opened it with some trepidation. Three letters fell out, one in what I recognised as his sister's writing, the other two plainly addressed by someone else. Jamie picked up the letter from his sister, eyed it as though it might contain something explosive, and set it gently down by the fruit bowl on the table.
"I'll start with Ian," he said, picking up the second letter with a grin. "I'm not sure I want to be reading Jenny's without a glass of whiskey in my hand."
He prized off the seal with the tip of the silver fruit knife and opened the letter, scanning the first page.
"I wonder if he..."
His voice faded off as he began to read. Curious, I got up and stood behind his chair, looking over his shoulder. Ian Murray wrote a clear, large hand, and it was easy to read, even at a distance.
dear brother. All here are well, and give thanks to God for the news of your safe arrival in the colonies. I send this missive in care of Jocasta Cameron. Should it find you in her company, Jenny bids you to give her kindest regards to her aunt. You will see from the enclosed that you are restored to my wife's good graces. She has quite ceased to talk of you in the same breath with Old Scratch, and I have heard no recent references to emasculation, which may relieve your mind. To put aside jesting, her heart is much lightened by news of young Ian's safety, as is my own. You will know the depth of our gratitude at his deliverance, I think. Therefore, I will not weary you with repetitions, though in all truth I could write a novel upon that theme. We managed to keep all here fed, though the barley suffered much from hail, and there is a flux abroad in the village, which has claimed 2 children this month, to their parents' sorrow. It will be Annie Fraser and Alistair Kirby we have lost. May God have mercy on their innocence. On a happier note, we have had word from Michael in Paris. He continues to prosper in the wine business, and thinks of marrying soon. I take joy in acquainting you with news of the birth of my newest grandson, Anthony Brian Montgomery Lyle. I shall content myself with this announcement, leaving a fuller description to Jenny. She is besotted of him, as are we all. He is a dear lad. His father, Paul, Maggie's husband, is a soldier, so Maggie and wee Anthony bide here at Lallybroch. Paul is in France at present. We pray nightly he may be left there in relative peace, and not sent to the dangers of the colonies, nor the wilds of Canada. We have had visitors this week, Simon, Lord Lovett, and his companions. He has come a-gathering again, seeking recruits for the Highland regiment he commands. You will perhaps hear of them in the colonies, where I understand they have established some small reputation. Simon tells great tales of their bravery against the Indians and the wicked French, some of which are doubtless true. Jamie grinned at this and turned the page over. He quite enthralled Henry and Matthew by his stories, and the girls as well. Josephine, Kitty's eldest, Jamie observed in an aside to me, was so inspired indeed as to engineer a raid upon the chicken coop, wherefrom she and her cousins all emerged bedecked with feathers, mud from the kale yard being employed in lieu of war paint. As all wished to play savage, young Jamie, Kitty's husband, Geordie, and myself were pressed into service as the Highland Regiment, and obliged to suffer attack by tomahawk, kitchen spoons and ladles, and other forms of enthusiastic assault. We essaying, meanwhile, a valiant defence with our broadswords, pieces of lath and willow twigs. I put a stop to the suggestion that the thatch of the dovecot be set afire with flaming arrows, but was obliged in the end to submit to being scalped. I flattered myself that I survived this operation in better case than did the chickens.
The letter continued in this vein, giving more news of family, but dealing more often with the business of the farm and reports of events in the district. Emigration, Ian wrote, was become epidemic, with virtually all of the inhabitants of the village of Shogley having decided upon this expedient. Jamie finished the letter and put it down. He was smiling, his eyes faintly dreamy, as though he saw the cool mists and stones of Lallybroch rather than the humid, vivid jungle that surrounded us. The second letter was also addressed in Ian's hand, but marked private below the blue wax seal.
"What will this be, I wonder?" Jamie murmured, breaking the seal and unfolding it.
It began without salutation, obviously meant as a continuation to the larger letter.
"Now, brother, I have a matter of some concern to put to you, upon which I write separately, so that you might share my larger letter with Ian, without disclosing this matter. Your last letter spoke of putting Ian aboard ship in Charleston. Should this have occurred, we will, of course, welcome his coming with joy. However, if by chance he has not yet quitted your company, it is our wish that he remain with you, should this obligation be not unpleasing to you and to Claire."
"Not unpleasing to me,"
Jamie muttered, nostrils flaring slightly as he glanced from the page to the window. Ian and Rollo were wrestling on the grass with two young slaves, rolling over and over in a giggling tangle of limbs and cloth and wagging tail.
Mm-hmm.
He turned his back to the window and resumed reading.
I mentioned Simon Fraser to you and the cause of his presence here. The regimental levies have been a matter of concern to us for some time, though the matter has not often been pressing, our location being fortunately remote and difficult of travel. Lovett finds little trouble in inducing lads to take the king's shilling. What is there for them here? Poverty and want, with no hope of betterment. Why should they remain here, where they have nothing to inherit, where they are forbidden the plaid or the right to carry a man's weapons? Why should they not seize the chance of reclaiming the notion of manhood, even should it mean they wear the tartan and carry the sword in the service of a German usurper? I think sometimes this is the worst of it. Not only that murder and injustice have been loosed unchecked upon us, without hope of cure or recourse, but that our young men, our hope and future, should be thus piped away, squandered for the profit of the conqueror, and paid in the small coin of their pride.
Jamie looked up at me, one brow raised.
You wouldn't have thought to look at him that Ian had such poesy in him, eh?
There was a break in the text here. When it resumed, toward the bottom of the page, the writing, which had sprawled above into an angry scrawl with frequent blots and scratches, was once more controlled and tidy.
I must beg pardon for the passion of my words. I had not meant to say so much, but the temptation to open my heart to you, as I always have, is overwhelming. These are things I would not say to Jenny, though I imagine she knows them. To the point, then. I grew garrulous. Young Jamie and Michael are well enough for the present. At least we have no fear that either of them will be tempted by a soldier's life. The same is not true of Ian. You know the lad and his spirit of adventure so similar to your own. There is no real work for him here, yet he has not the mind of a scholar or a head for business. How shall he fare in a world where he must choose between beggary and the profession of war? For there is little else. We would have him stay with you, if you will have him. It may be that there is a greater opportunity in the new world for him than might be found here. Even if this should not be so, his mother will at least be spared the sight of her son marching away with his regiment. I could ask no better guardian or example for him than yourself. I know I ask a great favour of you in this matter. Still, I hope the situation will not be entirely without benefit to you, beyond the presumed great pleasure of Ian's company. Not only a poet, but an ironist too, Jamie observed, with another glance at the boys on the lawn.
Here there was another break in the text, before the writing resumed, this time with a freshly sharpened quill, the words written carefully, reflecting the thought behind them.
I had left off writing, brother, wishing my thoughts to be clear and unmazed by weariness before addressing this concern. I have, in fact, taken up my pen and put it down a dozen times, unsure whether to speak at all. I fear to offend you. In the same breath, I ask your favour. And yet I must speak. I wrote of Simon Fraser earlier. He is a man of honour, though his father's son, but he is a bloody man. I've known him since all of us were lads. Sometimes that seems but yesterday, and then again a gulf of years. And there is a hardness in him now, a glimpse of steel at the back of his eyes that was not there before Culloden. What troubles me, and the knowledge you bear of my love toward you is all that emboldens me to say this, is that I have seen that steel in your own eyes, brother. I know too well the sights that freeze a man's heart, to harden his eyes in that fashion. I trust that you will forgive my frankness, but I have feared for your soul many times since Culloden. I've not spoken of the matter to Jenny, but she has seen it too. She is a woman, forby, and will know you in ways I cannot. It will be that fear, I think, that caused her to throw Lyra at your head. I did think the match ill-made, but...
Here, a large, deliberate blotch obscured several lines.
You are fortunate in Claire.
Mm-hmm, Jamie said at this, giving me an eye. I squeezed his shoulder and leaned forward to read the rest.
It is late, and I ramble. I spoke of Simon. Care for his men is now his sole link with humanity. He has neither wife nor child. He lives without root or half. His patrimony hostage to the conqueror he serves. There is a burning fire in such a man, but no heart. I hope never to see the same of you, or of young Ian. Thus, I give you to each other, and may God's blessing, and mine, be with you both. Write as soon as you may. We hunger for news of you, and for your accounts of the exotic precincts in which you now abide. Your most affectionate brother, Ian Murray.
Jamie carefully folded the letter and put it into his coat.
Mm-hmm, he said.
Chapter 11. The Law of Bloodshed.
July 1767.
I became gradually accustomed to the rhythm of life at River Run. The presence of the Slays disturbed me, but there was little I could do about that, save to call upon their services as little as I could, fetching and carrying for myself whenever possible. River Run boasted a simple's room, essentially a small closet in which dried herbs and medicines were kept. There wasn't much there, no more than a few jars of dandelion root and willow bark, and a few patent poultices dusty from disuse. Jocasta professed herself delighted that I should want to use the space. She had herself no talent for medicinals, she said with a shrug, nor had any of the slaves. There is a new woman who may show some skill in that direction, she said, long fingers drawing out the line of wool from the spindle as the spinning wheel whirled round. She is not a house slave, though. She was fresh come from Africa only a few months past, and has neither speech nor manners. I had thought to train her, perhaps, but since you are here... Ah, now the thread's grown too thin, do you see? While I spent some time each day chatting with Jocasta and attempting to learn from her the art of spinning wool, Jamie spent an hour or two with the butler, Ulysses, who, in addition to serving as Jocasta's eyes and as major domo of the house, had evidently also been managing the accounts of the plantation since Hector Cameron's death.
"And doing a fair job of it, too," Jamie told me privately after one such session. "If he were a white man, my aunt would have no difficulty in handling her affairs. As it is, though..."
He shrugged. "As it is... It's lucky for her that you're here," I said, leaning close to sniff at him. He had spent the day in Cross Creek, arranging a complicated exchange involving indigo blocks, lumber, 3 pairs of mules, 5 tons of rice, and a warehouse receipt for a gilded clock. And as a result, a fascinating variety of scents clung to his coat and hair.
"That's the least I can do," he said, his eyes on the boots he was brushing.
His lips tightened briefly.
"Not as though I were otherwise occupied, is it?"
"A dinner party," Jocasta declared a few days later. "I must have a proper festival to introduce the two of you to the folk of the county."
"There's no need of it, aunt," Jamie said mildly, looking up from his book. "I think I shall have met most of the county at the stock buying last week. Or the masculine part of it, at least," he added, smiling at me. "Come to think on it, though, perhaps it would suit Claire to be acquainted with the ladies of the district."
"I wouldn't mind knowing a few more people," I admitted. "Not that I don't find ample occupation here," I assured Jocasta, "but..."
"But not of a sort that interests you," she answered,
though with enough of a smile to take the sting out of the remark.
"You've no great fondness for needlework, I think."
Her hand went to the big basket of coloured wools and plucked out a ball of green to be attached to the shawl she was knitting.
The balls of wool were carefully arranged each morning by one of the maids in a spiral spectrum, so that by counting, Jocasta could pick up a ball of the right colour.
"I will. Not that sort of needlework," Jamie put in, closing his book and smiling at me. "It's more the stitching of severed flesh that appeals to Claire. I expect she'll be getting restless these days. We know more than a cracked head or a case of piles to be dealing with."
"Ha, ha," I said tartly. But in fact, he was quite right. While I was pleased to find that the inhabitants of River Run were, on the whole, healthy and well-nourished, there wasn't a great deal of scope for a physician. While I certainly wished no ill to anyone, there was no denying that I was getting restless. So was Jamie, but I thought that was a matter better left unremarked for the moment. "I do hope Masali's quite well," I said, changing the subject. Convinced at last that Jamie wouldn't require his aid for a little while, Fergus had left the day before, bound downriver for Wilmington, thence to take ship for Jamaica. If all went well, he would return in the springtime with Masali and, God willing, their new child.
"So do I," said Jamie. "I told Fergus that—"
Jocasta turned her head sharply toward the door.
"What is it, Ulysses?"
Absorbed by the conversation, I hadn't noticed footsteps in the hallway. Not for the first time, I was struck by the acuteness of Jocasta's hearing.
"Mr. Farquhar Campbell," the butler said quietly, and stood back against the wall.
It was an indication of Farquhar Campbell's familiarity with the household, I thought, that he shouldn't have waited for Ulysses to return with an invitation for him to enter. He came into the drawing-room on the butler's heels, hat carelessly thrust beneath one arm.
"Jo, Mrs. Fraser," he said, with a quick bow to Jocasta and me, and "your servant, sir," to Jamie.
Mr. Campbell had been riding, and riding hard. The skirts of his coat were thick with dust, and sweat streamed down his face beneath a wig crammed on askew.
"What is it, Farquhar? Has something happened?"
Jocasta sat forward on the edge of her chair, her face reflecting his obvious anxiety.
"Yes," he said abruptly, "an accident at the sawmill. I've come to ask Mrs. Fraser—"
"Yes, of course. Let me get my box. Ulysses, will you have someone fetch a horse?" I rose hastily, searching for the slippers I had kicked off. I wasn't dressed for riding, but from Campbell's look there wasn't time to change. "Is it serious?" He put out a hand to stop me as I stooped to pull my slippers on.
"Aye, bad enough. But you needn't come, Mrs. Fraser. If your husband might fetch along some of your medicines and such, though—"
"Of course I'll come," I said.
"No."
He spoke abruptly, and we all stared at him. His eyes sought Jamie's, and he grimaced, lips tight.
"It's not a matter for the ladies," he said, "but I should be most grateful for your company, Mr. Fraser."
Jocasta was on her feet before I could protest, gripping Campbell's arm.
"What is it?" she said sharply. "Is it one of my negroes? Has Burns done something?"
She was taller than he by an inch or two. He had to look up to answer her. I could see the lines of strain in his face, and she plainly sensed it as well. Her fingers tightened on the grey serge of his coat sleeve. He glanced at Ulysses, then back at Jocasta. As though he had received a direct order, the butler turned and left the room, soft-footed as ever.
"It is a matter of bloodshed, Joe," he said to her quietly. "I do not know who, or how, or nor even how bad the injury may be. McNeil's boy came for me. But for the other—"
He hesitated, then shrugged.
"It is the law."
"And you're a judge," she burst out. "For God's sake, can you not do something?"
Her head moved jerkily, blind eyes trying to fix him, bend him to her will.
"No,"
he said sharply, and then more gently repeated,
"No."
He lifted her hand from his sleeve and held it tightly.
"You know I cannot," he said. "If I could—" "If you could, you would not," she said bitterly.
She pulled her hand out of his grasp and stood back, fists clenched at her sides.
"Go on, then.
They've called ye to be judge. Go and give them their judgment.
She whirled on her heel and left the room, her skirts rustling with angry futility. He stared after her, then, as the sound of a slammed door came from down the passage, blew out his breath with a wry grimace, and turned to Jamie.
"I hesitate to request such a favour of you, Mr. Fraser, upon such short acquaintance as we have had, but I would greatly appreciate your accompanying me upon my errand. Since Mrs. Cameron herself cannot be present, to have you there as her representative in the matter—" "What is this matter, Mr. Campbell?"
Jamie interrupted. Campbell glanced at me, plainly wishing me to leave. Since I made no move to do so, he shrugged, and pulling a handkerchief from his pocket, wiped his face.
"It is the law of this colony, sir, that if a negro shall assault a white person, and in so doing cause blood to be shed, then he shall die for his crime."
He paused, reluctant.
"Such occurrences are most thankfully rare, but when they occur—"
He stopped, lips pressed together. Then he sighed, and with a final pat of his flushed cheeks, put the handkerchief away.
"I must go. Will you come, Mr. Fraser?"
Jamie stood for a moment longer, his eyes searching Campbell's face.
"Ah, well,"
he said abruptly. He went to the sideboard and pulled open the upper drawer where the late Hector Cameron's dueling pistols were kept. Seeing this, I turned to Campbell. "Is there some danger?"
"I cannot say, Mrs. Fraser."
Campbell hunched his shoulders.
"Donald McNeil told me only that there had been an altercation of some kind at the sawmill, and that it was a matter of the law of bloodshed. He asked me to come at once to render judgment and oversee the execution, and then left to summon the other estate owners before I could obtain any particulars."
He looked unhappy, but resigned. "Execution? Do you mean to say you intend to execute a man without even knowing what he's done?" In my agitation, I had knocked Jocasta's basket of yarn over. Little balls of coloured wool ran everywhere, bouncing on the carpet.
"I do know what he's done, Mrs. Fraser."
Campbell lifted his chin, his colour high, but with an obvious effort swallowed his impatience.
"Your pardon, ma'am. I know you are newly come here. You will find some of our ways difficult and even barbarous, but—"
"Too right I find them barbarous. What kind of law is it that condemns a man—"
"A slave?"
"A man. Condemns him without trial, without even an investigation? What sort of law is that?"
"A bad one, madam," he snapped. "But it is still the law, and I am charged with its fulfilment. Mr. Fraser, are you ready?"
He clapped the hat on his head and turned to Jamie.
"I am."
Jamie finished stowing the pistols and ammunition in the deep pockets of his coat, and straightened, smoothing the skirts down across his thighs.
"Sassenach, will you go and—"
I had crossed to him and grabbed him by the arm before he could finish. "Jamie, please, don't go. You can't be a part of this."
"Hush."
He laid his hand on mine and squeezed hard. His eyes held mine and kept me from speaking.
"I am already part of it," he said quietly. "It is my aunt's property, her men involved. Mr. Campbell is right. I am her kinsman. It will be my duty to go, to see at least, to be there."
He hesitated then, as though he might say more, but instead merely squeezed my hand again and let me go. "Then I'm going with you." I spoke quite calmly, with that eerie sense of detachment that comes with awareness of impending disaster. His wide mouth twitched briefly.
"I did expect you would, Sassenach. Go and fetch your wee box, I'll have the horses brought round."
I didn't wait to hear Mr. Campbell's expostulations, but fled toward the stillroom, my slippers pattering on the tiles like the beat of an anxious heart. We met Andrew McNeil on the road, resting his horse in the shade of a chestnut tree. He had been waiting for us. He stepped out of the shadows at the sound of our hoofbeats. He nodded to Campbell as we halted by him, but his eyes were on me, frowning.
"Did you not tell him, Campbell?" he said,
and turned the frown on Jamie.
"It will be no affair for a woman, Mr. Fraser. You called it a matter of bloodshed, did you know?"
Jamie said, a marked edge in his voice.
"My wife is Ban Leecha. She has seen war with me, and more. If you wish me there, she will go with me."
McNeil's lips pressed tight together, but he didn't argue further. He turned abruptly and swung into his saddle.
"Acquaint us, McNeil, with the history of this unfortunate affair."
Campbell urged his mare's nose past the withers of Jamie's horse, skilfully edging between McNeil and Jamie.
"Mr. Fraser is newly come, as you know, and your lad said only to me that it was bloodshed. I have no particulars."
McNeil's burly shoulders rose slightly, shrugging toward the iron-grey pigtail that bisected his collar. His hat was jammed down on his head, set square with the shoulders, as though he had used a carpenter's level to even it. "A square, blunt man, McNeil, in words as well as appearance." Told in brief bursts as we trotted, it was a simple story. The sawmill's overseer, Burns, had had an altercation with one of the turpentine slaves. This man, being armed with a large slash knife appropriate to his occupation, had attempted to settle the matter by removing Burns's head. Missing his aim, he had succeeded only in depriving the overseer of an ear.
"Barked him like a pine tree," McNeil said,
a certain grim satisfaction apparent in his voice.
"Took his lug, and a wee bit o' the side of his face as well. Not that it will ha' impaired his beauty o'er much, the ugly wee pussbag."
I glanced toward Jamie, who lifted one eyebrow in response. Evidently Burns was no favourite with the local planters. The overseer had shrieked for help, and with the assistance of two customers and several of their slaves, had succeeded in subduing his assailant. The wound staunched and the slave locked in a shed, young Donald McNeil, who had come to have a saw blade set and found himself unexpectedly in the midst of drama, had been dispatched at once to spread the word to the plantation owners nearby.
"He'll not know," Campbell explained, twisting in his saddle to speak to Jamie. "When a slave must be executed, the slaves from those plantations nearby are brought to watch. A deterrent, aye, against future ill-considered action."
"Indeed,"
Jamie said politely.
"I believe that was the Crown's notion in executing my grandsire on Tower Hill after the Rising. Very effective, too. All my relations have been quite well behaved since."
I had lived long enough among Scots to appreciate the effects of that little jab. Jamie might have come at Campbell's request, but the grandson of the old fox did no man's bidding lightly, nor necessarily held English law in high regard. McNeil had got the message all right. The back of his neck flushed turkey red, but Farquhar Campbell looked amused. He uttered a short, dry laugh before turning round.
"Which slave is it, do you know?"
he asked the older man. McNeil shook his head.
"Young Donald, didn't he see? But you ken as well as I do it'll be that bugger Rufus."
Campbell's shoulders slumped in acknowledgement.
"Joe will be sore pained to hear it," he murmured, shaking his head regretfully. "It's our own fault," McNeil said, brutally thwacking a horse fly that had settled on his leg above the boot. "Yon Burns is na fit to mind pigs, let alone run negroes. I've told her often enough, so have you."
"Aye, but Hector hired the man, not Joe,"
Campbell protested mildly, "and she couldna well dismiss him out of hand. What's she to do, then? Come and manage the place herself?"
The answer was a grunt as McNeil shifted his broad buttocks in the saddle. I glanced at Jamie, and found him poker-faced, eyes hidden in the shadow under the brim of his hat.
"There's little worse than a willful woman," McNeil said,
a trifle louder than strictly necessary.
They've none to blame save themselves if harm comes to them.
Whereas, I chipped in, leaning forward and raising my own voice enough to be heard over the clop and creak of the horses, if harm comes to them because of some man, the satisfaction of blaming him will be adequate compensation. Jamie snorted briefly with amusement. Campbell cackled out loud and poked McNeil in the ribs with his crop.
"Got you there, Andrew," he said.
McNeil didn't reply, but his neck grew even redder. We rode in silence after that, McNeil's shoulders hunched just under his ears. While mildly satisfying, this exchange did nothing to settle my nerves. My stomach was knotted in dread of what might happen when we reached the mill. Despite their dislike of Burns and the obvious assumption that whatever had happened had likely been the overseer's fault, there wasn't the slightest suggestion that this would alter the slave's fate in any way. A bad law, Campbell had called it, but the law nonetheless. Still, it was neither outrage nor horror at the thought of judicial atrocity that made my hands tremble and the leather reins slick with sweat. It was wondering what Jamie would do. I could tell nothing from his face. He rode relaxed, left hand on the reins, the right curled loosely on his thigh near the bulge of the pistol in his coat. I wasn't even sure whether I could take comfort in the fact that he had allowed me to come with him. That might mean that he didn't expect to commit violence. But in that case, did it mean he would stand by and let the execution happen? And if he did? My mouth was dry, my nose and throat choked with the soft brown dust that rose in clouds from the horse's hooves.
I am already part of it.
Part of what, though? Of clan and family, yes. But of this? Highlanders would fight to the death for any cause that touched their honour or stirred their blood, but they were, for the most part, indifferent to outside matters. Centuries of isolation in their mountain fastnesses had left them disinclined to meddle in the affairs of others. But woe to any who meddled in theirs. Plainly, Campbell and McNeil saw this as Jamie's affair. But did he? Jamie wasn't an isolated Highlander, I assured myself. He was well-travelled, well-educated, a cultured man. And he knew damn well what I thought of present matters. I had a terrible feeling, though, that my opinion would count for very little in the reckoning of this day. It was a hot and windless afternoon, with cicadas buzzing loudly in the weeds along the road. But my fingers were cold and stiff on the reins. We had passed one or two other parties, small groups of slaves moving on foot in the direction of the sawmill. They didn't look up as we passed, but melted aside into the bushes, making room as we cantered past. Jamie's hat flew off, knocked by a low branch. He caught it deftly and clapped it back on his head, but not before I had caught a glimpse of his face, unguarded for a moment, the lines of it tense with anxiety. With a small shock, it occurred to me that he didn't know what he was going to do either, and that frightened me more than anything else so far. We were suddenly in the pine forest. The yellow-green flicker of hickory and alder leaves gave way abruptly to the darker light of cool, deep green, like moving from the surface of the ocean into the calmer depths. I reached back to touch the wooden case strapped on behind my saddle, trying to avoid thinking of what might lie ahead by making mental preparations for the only role I might reasonably play in this incipient disaster. I likely couldn't prevent damage, but I could try to repair what had happened already. Disinfection and cleansing. I had a bottle of distilled alcohol and a wash made from pressed garlic juice and mint. Then dress the wound. Yes, I had linen bandages, but surely it would need stitching first. In the midst of wondering what had been done with Burns's detached ear, I stopped. The buzzing in my own ears was not from cicadas. Campbell, in the lead, reined up sharply, listening, and the rest of us halted behind him. Voices in the distance. Lots of voices. in a deep, angry buzz like a hive of bees turned upside down and shaken. Then there was the faint sound of shouts and screams, and the sudden loud report of a shot. We galloped down the last slope, dodging trees, and thundered into the sawmill's clearing. The open ground was filled with people, slaves and bondsmen, women and children, milling in panic through the stacks of sawn lumber like termites exposed by the swing of an axe. Then I lost all consciousness of the crowd. All my attention was fixed at the side of the mill, where a crane hoist was rigged, with a huge curved hook for raising logs to the level of the sawbed. Impaled on the hook was the body of a black man, twisting in horrid imitation of a worm. The smell of blood struck sweet and hot through the air. There was a pool of it on the platform below the hoist. My horse stopped, fidgeting, obstructed by the crowd. The shouts had died away into moans and small, disconnected screams from women in the crowd. I saw Jamie slide off in front of me and force his way through the press of bodies toward the platform. Campbell and McNeil were with him, shoving grimly through the mob. McNeil's hat fell off, unregarded, to be trampled underfoot. I sat frozen in my saddle, unable to move. There were other men on the platform near the hoist. A small man, whose head was wound grotesquely round with bandages, splotched with blood all down one side. Several other men, white and mulatto, armed with clubs and muskets, making occasional threatening jabs at the crowd. Not that there seemed any urge to rush the platform. To the contrary, there seemed a general urge to get away. The faces around me were stamped with expressions ranging from fear to shocked dismay, with only here and there a flash of anger or satisfaction. Farquhar Campbell emerged from the press, boosted onto the platform by McNeil's sturdy shoulder, and advanced at once on the men with clubs, waving his arms and shouting something I couldn't hear, though the screams and moans around me were dying away into the silence of shock. Jamie seized the edge of the platform and lifted himself up after Campbell, pausing to give a hand to McNeil. Campbell was face to face with Burns, his lean cheeks convulsed with fury.
"Unspeakable brutality," he was shouting.
His words came unevenly, half swallowed in the shuffle and murmur around me, but I saw him jab a finger emphatically at the hoist and its grisly burden. The slave had stopped struggling. He hung inert. The overseer's face was invisible, but his body was stiff with outrage and defiance. One or two of his friends moved slowly toward him, plainly meaning to offer support. I saw Jamie stand for a moment, assessing events. He drew both pistols from his coat and coolly checked the priming. Then he stepped forward and clapped one to Burns's bandaged head. The overseer went rigid with surprise.
"Bring him down," Jamie said to the nearest thug, loudly enough to be audible over the dying grumbles of the crowd. "Or I blow off what's left of your friend's face." "And then?"
He raised the second pistol and aimed it squarely at the man's chest. The expression on Jamie's own face made further threats unnecessary. The man moved reluctantly, narrowed eyes fixed on the pistol. He took hold of the brake handle of the winch that controlled the hoist and pulled it back. The hook descended slowly, its cable taut with the strain of its burden. There was a massive sigh from the spectators as the limp body touched the earth. I had managed to urge my horse forward through the crowd till I was within a foot or two of the end of the platform. The horse shied and stamped, tossing his head and snorting at the strong smell of blood, but was well trained enough not to bolt. I slid off, ordering a man nearby to bring my box. The boards of the platform felt strange underfoot, heaving like the dry land does when one steps off a ship. It was no more than a few steps to where the slave lay. By the time I reached him, that cold clarity of mind that is the surgeon's chief resource had come upon me. I paid no heed to the heated arguments behind me or to the presence of the remaining spectators. He was alive.
His chest moved in small, jerky gasps.
The hook had pierced the stomach, passing through the lower ribcage, emerging from the back at about the level of the kidneys. The man's skin was an unearthly shade of dark blue-grey, his lips blanched to the colour of clay.
"Hush," I said softly, though there was no sound from the slave save the small hiss of his breath. His eyes were pools of incomprehension, pupils dilated, swamped with darkness. There was no blood from his mouth. The lungs were not punctured. The breathing was shallow but rhythmic. The diaphragm hadn't been pierced. My hands moved gently over him, my mind trying to follow the path of the damage. Blood oozed from both wounds, flowed in a black slick over the ridged muscles of back and stomach, shone red as rubies on the polished steel. No spurting. They had somehow missed both abdominal aorta and the renal artery. Behind me, a heated argument had broken out. Some small detached portion of my mind noted that Burns's companions were his fellow overseers from two neighbouring plantations, presently being rebuked with vigour by Farquhar Campbell.
"Blatant disregard of the law! You shall answer for it in court, gentlemen, be assured that you shall." "What does it matter?" came a sullen rumble from someone. "It's bloodshed and mutilation. Burns has his rights." "Rights no for the likes of you to decide," McNeil's deep growl joined in. "Rabble, that's what you are. No better than the..."
"And where do you get off, old man, sticking your long Scotch nose in where it's not wanted, eh?"
"What will you need, Sassenach?" I hadn't heard him come up beside me, but he was there. Jamie crouched next to me, my box open on the boards beside him. He held a loaded pistol still in one hand, his attention mostly on the group behind me. "I don't know," I said. I could hear the argument going on in the background, but the words blurred into meaninglessness. The only reality was under my hands. It was slowly dawning on me that the man I touched was possibly not fatally wounded, in spite of his horrible injury. From everything I could sense and feel, I thought that the curve of the hook had gone upward through the liver. Likely the right kidney was damaged, and the jejunum or gallbladder might be nicked, but none of those would kill him immediately. It was shock that might do for him, if he was to die quickly. But I could see a pulse throbbing in the sweat-slick abdomen just above the piercing steel. It was fast, but steady as a drumbeat. I could feel it echo in the tips of my fingers when I placed a hand on it. He had lost blood. The scent of it was thick, overpowering the smell of sweat and fear, but not so much as to doom him. An unsettling thought came to me. I might be able to keep this man alive. Likely not. In the wake of the thought came a flood of all the things that could go wrong. Hemorrhage when I removed the hook being only the most immediate. Internal bleeding, delayed shock, perforated intestine, peritonitis. And yet. At Prestonpans I had seen a man pierce through the body with a sword, the location of the wound very much like this. He had received no treatment beyond a bandage wrapped around his body. And yet he had recovered.
"Lawlessness," Campbell was saying, his voice rising over the babble of argument. "It cannot be tolerated, no matter the provocation. I shall have you all taken in charge, be sure of it."
No one was paying any attention to the true object of the discussion. Only seconds had passed, but I had only seconds more to act. I placed a hand on Jamie's arm, pulling his attention away from the debate. "If I save him, will they let him live?" I asked him, under my breath. His eyes flicked from one to another of the men behind me, weighing the possibilities. "No," he said softly. His eyes met mine, dark with understanding. His shoulders straightened slightly, and he laid the pistol across his thigh. I couldn't help him make his choice. He could not help with mine. But he would defend me, whichever choice I made. "'Give me the third bottle from the left, top row,' I said, with a nod at the lid of the box, where three rows of clear glass bottles, firmly corked, held a variety of medicines. I had two bottles of pure alcohol, another of brandy. I poured a good